Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I just found a collection of food gadgets that I never knew I wanted. How about the Anti-Loneliness Ramen Bowl? It has a pocket in the rim for your iPhone so you can FaceTime while you eat. Erica Grant, who blogs for The Food Beast, amassed what she calls the earth-shattering food inventions list, and it's a hoot. For instance, a tongue glove toothbrush. This is a plastic mitten that slips over your tongue, and it has a rim of teeth, just like Jaws. You can be brushing your teeth in a crowd, and no one will know. But the favorite of all computer slaves is going to be the crumb-proof keyboard with the built-in dinner plate. Of course, there's one problem here. It's not dishwasher safe. Stay with us for a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Sean Brock is the Charleston chef who's made news as a one-man revival movement and as a James Beard nominee for Outstanding Chef in the United States. His cause is bringing back the forgotten foods of the South, and he understands that the past feeds the present. And to know the past, you run into that word origin, where foods began. And that's when the fun really starts. Well, Sean took a trip recently. He's back. And he joins us from Charleston. Sean, it's good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I hear you're back from a trip to West Africa. Why West Africa?
Well, the cuisine that I study, we call the Low Country cuisine. And it's the cuisine of Charleston and Savannah and this whole region here. Uh-huh. And in my opinion, a lot of the dishes are influenced by West Africa because of the Atlantic slave trade and the rice plantations, the indigo, and the cotton, which were the three major crops here in Charleston. So basically, if you try and understand how a cuisine works, you have to understand the importance of the cultural influences. And the major cultural influence is West Africa. So I went there to do a little bit of research with some plants, some specific peas and rice and things. But I really wanted to see the original, truest, and most honest form of all these classic dishes that we call Southern dishes and that we consider Southern food. Things like gumbo and jambalaya and black-eyed pea fritters and hoppin' John. And I really wanted to see where they came from and see them in their most original form and then kind of take a look at where they are today.
Uh-huh.
And you know, try and explain that because it's amazing how a dish can change when it moves to a new place, and there are different cultural influences. So I was there cooking with people who have the same interests. One day, in fact, I cooked with four generations. It was unbelievable.
What was the dish that you were making with the four generations?
It's our version of gumbo. And what was incredible was it looked exactly like our gumbo.
Ah.
Looked exactly like it, but it was completely different. It didn't have tomato, it didn't have a roux, but the colors were the same, the texture was the same, the flavor was the same.
Did it have the filet, the dried sassafras leaves for thickening?
They have a different thickener, but it's almost the same thing.
Uh-huh.
It's nebedai, and it's very, very similar. It's like a bush, small tree, and the leaves are used in lots and lots of dishes there, and I may or may not have brought some back in my luggage, if you want to try it.
We don't have to go there. You know, I know one of the things that if I were to ever get to West Africa or anywhere in Africa, I just imagine that the peas and the beans would have to be fascinating.
Well, see, that's one of my passions, is collecting beans and peas. And when I went to that market where they have just bags and bags and bags of these things, people were actually, like, laughing at me because I was, like, buying so much of them. And the vendors were like, what is wrong with this guy? Like, why is he so excited about this? Because it's so common to them.
But they're not going to see it elsewhere, you know.
Oh, you wait till you see these things. They're just beautiful speckled black and gray peas and some that are all white and these beautiful red ones. And, you know, I may have or may not have brought some back in my luggage.
But the flavors are all different, I gather.
Completely different, you know, different levels of earthiness, different levels of sweetness, different starch levels, and they're all used for different applications. There was this dish that I'm actually making today at the restaurant that I learned there. It's called akara, and it's like street food. It's a black-eyed pea fritter. And what they do is they take black-eyed peas, or, well, not what we know of black-eyed peas. They're a little lighter in color. They're a little creamier colored. Uh-huh. And they take those and they soak them for a couple days and allow them to ferment. And then you rinse them a couple times, and you have to sit there with your hands rubbing these peas together to remove the outer hull.
That's like one by one, right?
I mean, yeah. It took 3 hours. Whoa. It took probably 3 hours to get all the hulls off these peas, all by hand, no machines. Then you have to wash away all the hulls and rinse and rinse and rinse. But, that, you know, that's the hard part. Then what blew my mind was they took the peas and smashed them in a mortar and pestle with some water, and then dropped them in some hot peanut oil, and they puffed up like a beignet. And I was asking, there's no baking powder in there? You know? And they're like, no. It's just two ingredients, water and peas. And I started thinking, it's the fermentation. It's the gas, the gas that's produced during the fermentation process that acted in the same way that baking powder acted. And these things were as light as a beignet. I mean, and the flavor of that lightly fermented cowpea was just amazing. And still one of those things that just haunts you. You know, it's like you have to have it again.
Right.
Because the pea was raw. Essentially, a pea was raw. So it wasn't this braised pea flavor. It was that raw pea flavor with that fermentation. And it was slightly sweet, but it had that sourness. There was so much complexity in a dish that was water and peas.
Ah, wow. And you're making it today.
I can't wait.
Ah, I wish I were there. Sean, thank you. Really intriguing.
Oh, thank you so much.
I could try this with almost any bean, probably.
Yes.
And get something that I've never tasted before.
Send me a picture of it.
You got it. Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Take care.
Sean Brock is chef and partner at Husk and McCrady's, both in Charleston. Well, while we're thinking about indigenous ingredients, I have to offer solace to you who work so hard for a perfect lawn. Now, for you, the dandelion is the enemy. For the rest of us, the dandelion is opportunity. Tiny greens make salad, mature greens cleanse like no one's business, but those yellow blooms are the very best. They tint rice, and they do this one-of-a-kind sorbet. Chef Jerry Traunfeld, who wrote the Herb Farm Cookbook, gave us this recipe for dandelion petal sorbet. It's sweet and tart, and it really lights things up. And by the way, his tip to sidestep bitterness is to not use the white part of the petals. Okay, find the sorbet, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern had a goal: eat in every mom and pop place in the country. Well, that was 1970-something. Two grad students with an old map and an older VW bus. They were clueless Easterners driving west. But that's how road food began. Many editions later, they're still driving and still discovering superb eats. So they're never going to get done, which is great for us. Jane, Michael, great to have you back.
Hi, Lynn.
You know, one of the things I hear from barbecue aficionados is, no matter what anybody might say, the only true barbecue, the great barbecue, is either in the South or the West, and the rest of the country has no idea what they're doing. But you two travel all over the place. So what's your take on this?
I think 10 or 15 years ago, we would have agreed with that statement, that in fact, to eat really good barbecue, you must go south or to Texas or actually some of the cities of the Midwest where people came up from the south. Uh-huh. And, you know, the African-American communities there have like great barbecues in Detroit, in Chicago, in St. Louis. But in the last decade or so, I think to some degree that has changed. I mean, people have traveled enough, people have become appreciative enough of real barbecue that, in fact, there are outposts of genuinely excellent barbecue throughout as far as New England and certainly in New York. And that's what actually what we want to talk to you about today, which is a place called Big W's Roadside Barbecue in Wingdale, New York. Now, that's Putnam County, New York, the least likely place to find genuine barbecue.
Yes. And, you know, it's funny, Lynn. Michael and I live in New England, and we get very hungry, and it's not always convenient to drive to right. the hill country in Texas whenever we want to get a bite of barbecue. So, you know, it's like Pura saying, you know, the only good French bread is in France. Well, mm-hmm. that may be, but you know what? Open it up a little bit, and you can find some pretty decent barbecue in the East, in
so
the North.
What makes Big W's?
Well, for one thing, I have to tell you that Big W's has what I would call street cred. It started as a food truck and roadside smoke pit. It was not even a brick and mortar store. So this guy simply had a smoker by the side of the road, this guy meaning Warren Norstein, who started the place. And over the years, this has been there a while, over the years he developed a really loyal clientele because he does what the great pit masters of the South and West do, which is to use time and smoke and very little else to transform brisket, you know, which is essentially kind of tough to begin with,
right.
into the softest, juiciest meat you could ever imagine.
And it becomes, in some cases, pulled pork, which he does beautifully here.
And he makes great pork shoulders that, you know, are cooked long enough so that to actually pull them, you know, separate the meat mm-hmm, from the mm-hmm. fat, it's like it falls apart as you do it.
You know, my favorite thing to eat here, I think my favorite thing to eat anywhere actually is burnt ends. And I know, Lynn, we have discussed burnt
yes,
ends.
Yes,
do you
have.
Remember?
With great lust, yes.
Oh, yeah. My God. And he does burnt ends, which is very hard to find in most barbecues anywhere except really the Midwest. That's rib tips and burnt ends are a Chicago, St. Louis phenomena.
But I have to say, Lynn, you mentioned a lust for food.
Right.
Nothing to me creates more lust than the idea of cracklins, you know, which are kind of the non-kosher version of what a Jewish cook might call gribbenis, you know, the kind
the
of deep fried pieces
chicken.
Of chicken skin.
Yeah, right. Or coochie yeah. Frito.
In this case, we're talking about pork skin. And it's not a dish on the menu because it's way too intense. But actually, the last time we were there, we were lucky enough that he had just created, I don't even know how he does it, but there was a big pan full of cracklins ready to be used as decoration on his really good mashed potatoes.
Oh.
And let me tell you, like a mound of these chunky, hefty mashed potatoes topped with a bunch of kind of oily, deep-fried pig skin. I mean, it's basically deep-fried fat is what it is.
But is this a takeout place?
No, well, many people do come there to take out, but he has since gone from the truck, which was strictly takeout and a couple of picnic tables, to an indoor restaurant with tables. You walk up to the counter and place your order. And it's very interesting because Warren Norstein is not, you know, most barbecue men that we've met are very kind of silent types, like the John Wayne, very few words. Warren Norstein is more like a deli man. He'll talk your ear off, and while you're placing your order, he'll give you a nosh of this, a taste of that, just like you're at Katz's Deli on Houston Street in New York.
He's a barbecue schmoozer.
A barbecue schmoozer, which is great because he's giving little snacks. He's going around the room to make sure everyone's happy. But anyway, you place your order at the counter, and then I can't remember if you pick it up or if they bring it to you, but it's a very informal place, but it does have tables and chairs and booths.
I'm hungry.
I know. Thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of the newly updated roadfood.com. Head to the website to track their latest finding and take a minute to participate in our latest web project, Once Upon a Table, Tales of Eating with Mom and Dad. With Mother's Day behind us, we're forging ahead to Father's Day. And in his honor, we want to hear your stories or send us a recipe and photos about eating with your dad. And for your effort, we'll send you a Father's Day menu that we've created just for this occasion. It's delicious and very simple to pull off. Homemade onion dip, spice-crusted oven spare ribs, ginger sesame coleslaw, and a salty brownie sundae. Now, the recipes are yours only if you contribute. You can't find them anywhere else. That's Once Upon a Table, Tales of Eating with Mom and Dad, and you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the latest in sustainable meat, Siobhan, anybody? And the fallacy of the family dinner. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Be so good and yet be such a hard sell. But it's coming on strong right now because of how sustainable it is and how delicious if you know what you're doing. And knowing what you're doing is where Jesse Griffiths comes in. In his hometown of Austin, Texas, Jesse is famous for his Die Due butcher shop at the farmer's market and for his book, A Field, on hunting. Well, Jesse teaches hunting for the table and how to handle all kinds of local meats. And right now, he's doing a class on goat. Jesse, good to have you back. Welcome.
It's good to be here. Again, thank you.
Yeah, I realize I've heard for a long time that goat is the next big thing. Do you think its time has arrived?
Absolutely. I mean, the time has arrived, or arrived a long time ago around the world for goat. It's an incredibly popular meat. Beyond chicken, it's the most consumed meat in the world, and it is the most consumed red meat in the world because of its ability to thrive in pretty much any environment. And I think that people are, you know, coming around to that again, especially in this country. They're starting to realize that it is a very valid food source.
What does it taste like? If you've never had it, how do you describe it?
As with any animal, there's always a kind of a flavor that's there. So, I mean, if you've ever had goat cheese and then you eat goat, there's a bit of similarity there. Just like if you eat sheep milk cheese and lamb, there will be that yeah, slightly acidic note or that it's kind of hard to describe.
There are new names now. I think one name now is Siobhan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one that is a slightly older goat. I think up to a year and a half. And then the equivalent of lamb is the cabrito, which is very popular in northern Mexico and southern Texas.
So now you work with a particular farm usually, right? You like to use their goats in your classes. What do we have to know about goat to buy it?
Well, definitely the source of it. And I mean, that's a big part of everything that we do is just know your source. And we're very picky and we really like our producer, and that's Wendy Hill out in Comanche, and there's just something about it. And I know what it is. It's the way he raises them. They're raised on alfalfa, and then they forage naturally. And he harvests at appropriate sizes and ages, so we can get true cabrito from him, which is, you know, in the 15 to 20-pound range. Mm-hmm. And then the larger Siobhan, without them getting too big and where the flavor becomes a little more assertive. And of course, as the animal gets older, the flavor will become more pronounced. And cabrito, I think, is very accessible if people have never had anything like that. It's quite good.
Well, where should we be buying our goat? I mean, should we be going to halal markets because it's used so much in those cultures? Should we be in Mexican or Latin American places, or should we be going to farmers markets?
Well, your first stop should be the farmers market, because then you're going to be dealing directly with the producer and you'll be able to ask questions. Did these live outdoors? What were they fed? How old was the animal? And you can get a good sense of of the person that's raising them. And that should tell you a lot about how that food is going to be. And so, but beyond that, yes, a halal market or, you know, a Central American market or a Mexican market, they'll all, you know, likely have goat there. That goat will likely have come from Texas as well. We raise about 70% of the domestic market of goat here in this state just because it is so well suited for goats, or maybe poorly suited for other animals.
Yeah.
Because they can live in pretty harsh environments. And so we raise a lot of them here. But, you know, I always urge people to know your source. But beyond that, you know, just go to a market, ask some questions, and just experiment.
So let's talk briefly about cooking, though, about what are some of the tricks to know about when you're cooking goat?
Well, the less exercised cuts of any animal, like the loin, which is where the chops are, and the tenderloin, things like that, they want to be cooked very quickly. There's not a lot of connective tissue that's going to break down over a long period of time. So they're going to want to be cooked quickly and typically at high heats, you know, like on a grill or quick sear in a pan where the meat is still left at, you know, medium, maybe even medium rare. And it's perfectly all right to cook goat to medium rare, just like you would lamb. But the other cuts, you know, your shoulder, the shanks, legs, things like that, will want to be long cooked, you know, maybe smoked, maybe braised, pot roasted, things like that. You know, just basically the same techniques you would apply to any meat will apply to goat. And I highly recommend just using a lot of the same spices and seasonings, herbs, things like that, that people do with lamb with goat, because they tend to marry very well. Mint, for example, is beautiful with goat. And then spices like cumin and caraway, things like that.
Jesse, thank you.
Thank you.
Jesse Griffiths is a butcher, chef, and teacher in Austin, Texas. He's written A Field, A Chef's Guide to Preparing and Cooking Wild Game and Fish. Bruce Feiler could toss a monkey wrench into the dream of family togetherness at the dinner table. Bruce writes about contemporary family life. He's a New York Times columnist and a best-selling author. He's written The Secrets of Happy Families. And instead of going to the usual psychologists and sociologists, he talks to some of the most creative minds around. People from the military, from business, sports, technology, television, about what techniques they found to be the most successful with their families. Well, the answers aren't what you would expect, including the ones about family dinner. New York Times food columnist and mother, Melissa Clark, got some of the details.
Hi, Bruce. So great to talk to you.
Thank you, Melissa. Thank you for inviting me.
So, first of all, I was so relieved to hear that, after all the hoopla, that the family dinner isn't actually as important as we all were led to believe. Tell me about that.
Well, if there's one thing that parents have heard, it's that family dinner is important for kids. And the truth is, there is a lot of research to back that up. But here's the problem. It just simply doesn't work in a lot of our lives. A third of us are not doing it regularly. Americans rank 33 out of 35 countries in terms of eating meals together.
Wow.
But dig deeper into the research, and the news, as you said, is quite relieving for parents. Nothing has been more studied in this space than dinner time. Every you know, and like, and tens of thousands of meals has been cataloged. And it turns out there's only 10 minutes of conversation in any mealtime. The rest is taken up with take your elbows off the table and
pass the
ketchup, right? And all that kind of stuff. And that's important. But the point is, the research shows you can take that 10, 15 minutes, move it to any time of the day, and still have the same benefits. So if you can have family dinner, fantastic, bravo. But if you can't, if mom works late or a kid has a sports practice, you can meet for family breakfast if that's better in your schedule. You can meet at 8:30 after the kids have done some homework and everybody's home from work. You can have even one meal on the weekends. It can still have positive effect, because the point is, it's the family time that's important. It's the bonding time, that 15 minutes of conversation. That's what really matters. It's not having that bonding at the dinner table.
So you could even do that, say you're taking your kid to sports practice on the way in the car, for example.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I did was that I tested a bunch of different dinner table conversation games to find out which worked with people of different generations and which were the most effective. I mean, I'll just mention a couple. One is you can play a simple game. We do this now in my family where we play bad and good, where everybody will go around and talk about what happened bad to them. Everyone will talk about what happened good to them, parents and children. And in effect, parents are signaling, you know what, everything isn't going to go great. This is how I solved a problem today. We play a game now called Pain Points, where actually everybody talks about a difficult situation that they're facing in their life. Maybe a kid has to do a project with someone at school they don't like, or mom says, well, I really want to go to your soccer game on Tuesday, but I need to take grandma to the eye doctor. Suddenly the mom feels less stressed because she's being open about what she's facing, and suddenly the kids are engaging in solving the problem. You end up having an incredibly bonding experience over what was before that just a source of stress.
And it doesn't matter if you're doing that at the dinner table, if you're doing that on the way to the soccer game, or if you're doing that at breakfast, is what you're saying. It's the importance of the conversation itself. You wrote in your book about a chef from New Orleans named John Besh and his wife. They have a really interesting strategy of how they can come together for different types of meals. And I think this is a great inspiration. I was inspired by it.
Well, imagine this dilemma. Here's a guy who's devoted his life to food. He's obviously a celebrity chef now, owns many restaurants in New Orleans and in Texas. He's on TV all the time. Food is central to him, and yet, by definition, in his job, he's working in the evenings. And his wife, even more, just didn't have time. And one day he finds a McDonald's bag crumpled up in the pantry, and he brings it to a wife, like, kind of like a cat would bring a dead mouse to his wife, and he says, excuse me, what is this? And she was like, sorry, hotshot, I married a chef. I thought my problems would be solved. I don't like to cook, and I'm running your four kids around to sports practices. Sorry, I had to stop off. So it prompted this change, and they did a number of things. First of all, they decided to make a strategy where, okay, Dad, you like to cook. Make some extra food on the weekends that I can repurpose during the week, because she said, I don't mind repurposing food, but I don't have time or the inclination to make it from scratch. He took over breakfast, and then they made Sunday afternoons. He wasn't working. He made that the time where he would make a big pot of food, make extra for the week, invite the relatives over. Suddenly, they are taking an idea here, Melissa. This is the kind of larger theme that I learned while working on this book, which is there are ideas out there that can help parents. Time shifting is something we know from work. We time shift our TV shows. You can time shift family time. You don't need to have it all in the time that everybody thinks.
That's great. Another thing that you talk about in your book, and you also wrote an article in the Times about this, is the importance of family narratives. And as long as you talk about your family history together, that really is a great way for your family to come together and be cohesive. Can you talk about that?
I've written this column in the New York Times for a number of years now. This was the biggest response I ever had, the most emailed article in the Times for more than a month. And what it is I learned that high-functioning families have three things in common. They adapt all the time, they talk a lot, and they go out and play. But focusing on that second one for a second, they don't just talk about difficult conversations, as important as that is. They talk about what it means to be part of a family. Researchers at Emory gave kids a test about their family history. Do you know where your grandparents were born? Do you know where your parents went to high school? Do you know an aunt or an uncle who had an illness that they overcame? The kids who knew more about their family history had a higher sense of self-confidence and a greater belief that they could control their own lives. It was the single biggest predictor of a child's emotional well-being. And as the researchers explained to me, these kids have a sense that they're part of a larger family narrative. He said there are three types of family narratives. Ascending, we had nothing, we worked hard, we have a lot. Descending, oh, we had a lot, there was a storm or a recession or a war, we lost it all. Or there's an oscillating family narrative. Kids who understand that they come from an oscillating family narrative, we've had some success, but then your uncle lost his job. Oh, your mother was on the board of the hospital, but then you had an aunt who had breast cancer. Kids who understand that they come from that kind of a family know that when they hit their own hardships, which are inevitable, that they can push through, they can do it themselves. So that we all, everybody listening to this conversation, has somebody like that in their family. And the inclination is to stuff those skeletons in the closet. And if I've learned one thing, it's to open up those closet doors. You're actually serving your children well.
Bruce, thank you so much for talking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Bruce Feiler is the author of The Secrets of Happy Families. Melissa Clark is the author of Cook This Now. Well, Melissa left us with a recipe for corn salad with tomatoes, avocados, and lime cilantro dressing, just in case you want to do a family dinner. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it is time for me to talk to you. We can connect, 800-537-5252. And remember, you can always connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Lindsay's calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Lindsay?
Hi, Lynn. I am what I consider a novice foodie.
Uh-huh.
And I am looking, I'm a recent college graduate as well, so I have some spare time on my hands. And I am looking for blogs or resources to follow, or you know, some type of must-have book to start my foodie adventure.
I think one of the great sites is 101 Cookbooks. That's a really wonderful site because she cooks from books, and she talks about the recipes, and she talks about how she made them, and she shows you pictures, and she's a really good writer. And yet, by the same token, you know, she's not verbose. You're not going to have to read, you know, scroll down forever just to get to the nitty-gritty. And I think that's one great place. Kitchn, which is K-I-T-C-H-N, another great site, especially if you're starting out. I would say, you know, there's a lot of good starter books. Tell me the kinds of things you like to eat, because that's going to help.
Yes. I am starting to eat more fresh, organic type foods.
Right.
But I'm a big fan of Italian food and Cajun food as well.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think one of the people you would really enjoy is Heidi Swanson. She's done a book called Supernatural and some other books, and she's a vegetarian. Her recipes are dynamite. And there's a lot of the influences that you enjoy. Another Italian, in terms of Italian, Mario Batali's books. Simple, really straightforward, good food. The recipes work, and you can pick and choose what you like, but boy, it doesn't get more Italian than that. And then Lucinda Scala Quinn has done a book called Mad Hungry, Feeding Men and Boys, that you might really enjoy. And now she has a new one out. I can't remember the exact name, but it also begins with Mad Hungry. And it's really kind of practical cooking, but also really delicious food. She knows how to take a few ingredients and play with flavors in a way that they deliver amazing taste. And yet you're not fussing with, you know, a million different ingredients. Her recipes don't go on with 30 different things in them.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Now, I just a little self-promotion. Did a book called How to Eat Supper. There's a follow-up, How to Eat Weekends, but we've done those two. And How to Eat Supper is really your, you know, work night stuff. A lot of vegetables, a lot of Mediterranean influence, and also a lot of Asian influence in the recipes.
Fabulous.
So those are some good places to begin. And I would say the way you know if you've got a dependable recipe is where the author goes into detail. The author will say, you want a 4-quart saucepan and you want the heat to be medium. It should look like this, or, you know, cook it until the onions are clear, about 5 minutes. You want that detail. You don't want cook until done. You don't want put the blah, blah, blah into a pot, heat it, and let it simmer for 20 minutes. What kind of pot? How, you know, you need detail. And a lot of people look at longer recipes and say, oh, I can't do that. Well, the reality is a good writer is holding your hands. So that's one of the ways to check out a recipe.
Sure. Thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
You are off and running. You're going to be. This is a lifetime, and you're going to have a blast.
I will. I will. Thank you very much, Lynn.
Take care, Lindsay.
Yep. Bye-bye. Bye.
We're going to be back to take more of your questions in a minute. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, it is back to your questions. Let's connect. Pick up the phone. You can call 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org or track us on Facebook and Twitter. We've got Meredith calling from Mexico City. Meredith, hi, welcome.
Thank you. Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am very good. Are you living in Mexico City?
I do. I am living in Mexico City. I've lived here for 5.5 years.
I was there about 3 years ago. I could have stayed forever. It was fascinating. But what is
I loved your program about Jamaica Market. I play it for my students. I'm a teacher here.
What do you teach?
I teach English as a second language.
Yeah, that was my very first morning, and walking into that market, and there was a woman making blue corn tacos right on a pan. I mean, it was as though Central Casting had set it up. but what is your question?
Well, I'm getting married.
Congratulations.
Next month. Thank you so much. I'm very excited. And my fiancé and I are planning on inviting our friends and family after the civil ceremony for a picnic. And I thought it would be nice if we prepared most of the food ourselves. Now, there are about 50 adults and 10 children. Uh-huh. And I have some ideas, but I wanted to talk to you about, like, some nice do-ahead foods and kind of avoiding the soggy sandwich.
Yeah, I understand the phenomena. Well, tell me what your vision is. What are the ideas that you two have?
Well, I definitely would like to do some aguas frescas.
Oh, yes.
Fruit to start. Waters. Yeah. And then I have a couple salad ideas, kind of like American fusion, but mostly kind of just traditional American picnic, like a green salad, a potato salad, a quinoa and wild rice salad, a couscous salad, and then some sandwiches. And I was thinking, we're mostly vegetarian, but I think we could buy some like nice turkey too and do some veggie sandwiches and some turkey sandwiches. I really like Romanesco sauce and chimichurri and pesto. So I'm trying to see how I can combine these elements to work together in a picnic.
You know,
and not be too crazy.
No. This is what I'm thinking. I'm wondering. This is, self-promotion moment. But we were doing a quarterly ebook. And every quarter, there's a menu and, spin-offs that you can use on work nights and all that business. But this one is called The Big Summer Party. And one of the ideas in it is what I call table sauces. The idea of having very simple foods. Now, in your case, it could be the rolls and all the things you could put in those rolls and some salads. But marching down the table are the very sauces you're talking about. You could have all of those sauces, and everyone does what they wish with them. It makes it very easy for you.
Would you recommend rolls or baguettes or chapatas, or what do you think would be easiest?
I think whatever is easiest, but remember one thing. The smaller, the better, because people are going to want to try different things. First of all, putting them out on a platter would look wonderful, or just a wooden slab. Piling them, cut all of them, cut it so that I just have to lift it up and then I can tuck in it whatever I want.
Right. And you think the best way is to let everyone assemble them themselves? Because I was thinking that that might take away from chatting or in some ways I thought, maybe I should prepare the sandwiches mostly.
Yeah. And you
so
know what?
They...
You're getting married. Are you going to want to be making sandwiches the night before your wedding? I mean, let's get real. Come on. And you're supposed to have fun. I catered my own wedding, by the way. I speak
Really?
From experience, yes.
But how many people?
Oh, it was smaller. It was about 35. But I take that back. It was maybe 50. But the point is, I think you really want to, you know, give yourself a break. Now, that doesn't mean you're not going to be slicing rolls. Get friends in on this. But make the salads ahead. Cut up the fruit ahead. You can have everything set up in the fridge. It goes into coolers, and you don't put it in coolers. This is why you have friends.
Right. Great.
Okay.
Oh. And, well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, may it be a wonderful, wonderful party, and congratulations and all the happiness.
Thank you for your advice.
You're welcome, Meredith. You take care.
Bye.
800-537-5252 is how you can call us. You can email us at splendidtable.org. And, of course, you can go to Facebook and Twitter. Okay. Martin is calling from Rehoboth, Delaware, and I think I must have not said that correctly, Martin.
No, you did. Rehoboth, Delaware. How
are you? I can't believe it. I'm great. I'm great.
Hey, it's great to talk to you.
Well, it's good to talk to you. What do you want to talk about?
You know, this might be a little different for you because I'm looking to you for inspiration, not just for my table, but also for my garden.
Oh, this is hysterical. This is the woman who can grow herbs, and that's about it. You realize.
Oh, that's okay, but maybe you can help me because I'm not even good at that. My garden is never about the practicality of vegetables. It's always about painting flowers with a garden.
Oh, I love it.
I'm a painter and a designer, and you know, for me, food and the way it looks is so important because I always think it tastes good if it looks pretty.
Right, right.
So I'm kind of looking for ideas about, are there any edible flowers besides the typical nasturtiums and pansies that you see everywhere?
Well, yeah.
You know, that especially in the summertime when you've got all this great fresh fish and fresh vegetables, you know, what would work with that and what would complement those flavors?
Oh, my. Well, you know about the nasturtiums. I mean, the leaves and the flowers, they have a wonderful flavor. Okay, anything in the marigold family is edible.
Uh-huh.
And it tastes the way it smells.
Is that good?
Well, no, it's a green, aggressive. Well, no, I shouldn't say. The blooms are not that aggressive. I use marigold petals and dandelion petals the way you would use saffron.
Oh, okay.
You know, I put them in liquids and maybe broths, it may be rice, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, so there's the marigold / chrysanthemum family is edible. This is, we're assuming no sprays, okay?
Right, exactly.
Violets are edible. Roses. As I recall, some of the lily family, I want to say daylilies are edible. The petals are jasmine, mimosa, and depending where you live, those are available or they're not.
We can grow jasmine here.
You can grow jasmine. Okay, that's edible as well. And now one of the things that's done with that in the old golden olden days, people candied those flowers so that in a way that they actually looked like the flower but with a coating of crystal-like sugar and then just use them to decorate. But the you know, one of the things I love is that chives, it's very brief, but they get beautiful flowers. And herbs get flowers, you know, like thyme flowers, rosemary flowers. Every herb gets some sort of flower. It's usually not a big splashy flower, but it's quite lovely.
Now, once an herb goes to flower, is it then bitter in terms of the leaf?
If it's an annual like basil, yeah, the leaves turn bitter. The leaves are not fun, but the flowers are very pretty. They don't last a long time. But one of the great cooks I knew in Italy, she used to dry those flowers, and she used that as the flavoring for basil. And and they were really, it was really delicious. I mean, it was a completely different sensation, but it was great. So, so I think, and if you're talking about things like working with fish, I'm just thinking how lovely it would be to, you know, stuff a fish with something like rose petals. Although rose petals, you know what? Rose petals are wonderful if you steep them in cream.
Really?
And then make something like
either. Is anything bad with cream?
Well, no, nothing really is, as a matter of fact. And violets are the same way. And, of course, lavender is edible. Yeah, and the scent is fabulous. But anything creamy, like if you're going to make ice cream, you're going to make panna cotta, you're going to pour cream over any kind of fruit, you can warm it very gently with those flower petals in it and then let it steep a half hour, strain it, but then scatter the petals over the fruit. So imagine cut up strawberries with a pitcher of cream. You pour some cream over, or you whip the cream, and then you scatter the petals of the roses over the berries. I mean, this is drop-dead gorgeous. It's absolutely fabulous. And do you remember, like, Water for Chocolate, the film?
Yes. Oh, my God, yeah.
Well, the idea of doing things with mellow, velvety chili, those kinds of sauces where you then add rose petals or you add violets, it could be just wonderful. Do a honey dressing, honey and lime, with something like rose, violet, any one of the ones I've mentioned, and let that steep a little bit and then drizzle that over a piece of hot fish from the grill. It would be unbelievable.
I don't know whether to start with dessert or the main course now.
I always say start with dessert. The sugar will give you a lift, and then you can move on.
I'm just reassured that you think like me.
And I have to say, my dream is to have your garden. I think it takes genius, it takes an artist's eye, and it takes someone who really knows what they're doing in the garden. So my hat's off to you.
Well, thanks. You're welcome anytime.
I may show up. Martin, right. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
800-537-5252. You can reach us that way, and you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter. The name Marley, you think about music. Rohan Marley, son of the legendary Bob Marley, is adding something else to his family's legacy: coffee. In 1999, after a stint of playing college and professional football and feeling uncertain about his future, Rohan purchased a 52-acre coffee farm atop the Blue Mountains in Jamaica. What started as a two-man operation has blossomed into a successful fair trade, sustainable, and organic coffee business. Producer Jennifer Russell brings us his story.
So, Rohan, your family's name is synonymous with music, not farming and not coffee.
Right.
But farming's in your blood, isn't it?
Yeah, because originally, you know, my father grew up on a farm. And then as a Rastafarian and a Rastafari, we think that it's awesome that we can farm our own food. So it's always been in my blood. And the coffee was kind of, it was by chance. It was just a part of my destiny. And after college, I played some football in Canada. And after that, I went to live in New Jersey. I used to ask myself, you know, being Bob's son, you know, what's going to be my thing? Am I just going to sit around and collect royalties and do nothing? And inside of me, I had something I wanted to give. I wanted to do more from inside, you know? So a friend of mine, he called me from Jamaica, and there was this beautiful property available. It was so nice and luscious, this property, and the water was so blue and pristine that I couldn't believe that I had the opportunity to have this land, you know, bring this land into the family. And I thought it was a conspiracy, of course, because here I am, 26 years old. I know nothing about farming. I know nothing about anything besides football, you know. Mm-hmm. So the guy sold the property to me right there on the spot. And I said, you know, what's in this community? What's this property known for? He said, oh, Mr. Marley, this is coffee land. You're in the Blue Mountains of Jamaica. You have Blue Mountain coffee here. I said, I guess we're in the coffee business then. but then I said, you know, thinking about my principles and as a human being, my first instinct out of my mouth was, listen, if we're going to grow coffee here, you cannot use any chemical on the land. So I said, all right, Mr. Marley, we're going to do it your way. And that was in 1999. And, you know, it took me some time to kind of understand what it is that I was doing. because I had no clue that I had to get all these licenses to export the coffee. I had no clue that I had to do all this work. Mm-hmm. Well, it took me 10 years to to really understand what it is that I was doing. It's a learning process.
Yeah. I think it's cool you talk about promoting happiness and prosperity.
Yeah. Well, I'm joyful, you know. I don't want burdens, you know. So having this farm and seeing that the farmers are happy and that they're able to send their kids to school, and they're just so thankful for what is it I've done. I've done nothing. They're so thankful of my efforts that it just makes us happy, you know, both of us, myself and the community. And I brought Ziggy down to the community. Ziggy rebuilt the school. So that was kind of how I got into coffee.
Yeah.
That's a long story, right?
It's a great story. You know, a lot of people probably don't know that your father, Bob Marley, had a strong desire to become a farmer himself.
Yeah. He would always say in his interviews that, you know, one day he's going to stop playing music and he's going to go back to the farm. Like, I am the other side now, you know. I am my father's dream. I'm doing that because he said he wanted to do that. But it's really for myself, my own life, you know, really to, as a man, and having, leaving something for your children, children's children, and to bring something into my family's legacy outside of music, that we can now create an international business throughout the world, you know.
Rohan Marley, thank you so much.
Rastafari, I love, and thank you for your time.
Rohan Marley is the chairman and co-founder of Marley Coffee. Now, for more information, head to our website, splendidtable.org. Well, that's our show for this week. Hey, thanks for being with us. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Bob Marley, who said, "Reggae music takes its groove from the body movements of the working farmer, plowing the earth and chopping the bushes." Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Head over to splendidtable.org for information on anything you heard here today. You can look at our latest ebooks, download our weekly podcasts, rifle your way through our recipe box, and register for our book giveaway and for our e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalimi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift's our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.